Protest continues in the United States in the wake of the news that the Supreme Court is poised to reverse half a century of women's right to abortion based on the ruling in the case of Roe v. Wade. Essentially, it meant that abortion cannot be banned before the viability of the fetus at around 24 weeks. An historic case, Roe v. Wade. But as journalist and author Joshua Prager has written, the person most profoundly connected to it has remained unknown, the child whose conception occasioned the lawsuit, Baby Roe. Jane Roe's real name was Norma McCorvey. She never had the abortion she sought, and she gave the baby up for adoption. Norma McCorvey died in 2017. In his book, The Family Roe, Prager brought Norma McCorvey's three daughters together to talk about their mother's legacy. Baby Roe was Norma McCorvey's third child. It took some people by surprise that McCorvey never had an abortion. Joshua Prager joins me now. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for your time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is an extraordinarily complicated story, both on the legal and the human level. Did people think that Norma McCorvey had, in fact, succeeded in her quest to have an abortion?
Yes, everyone, myself included, sort of assumed that the woman who won the legal right to have an abortion had one. But I then was reading an article 12 years ago. This book took me a very long time. And it was mentioned in passing that, in fact, she hadn't. And then, of course, that seemed to me suddenly obvious because a lawsuit takes longer than a pregnancy. And then I started, you know, this idea came to me that, wow, even though Norma, Jane Roe, the plaintiff in this case, relinquished the child she had to adoption, I assumed, correctly, it turned out, that somehow he or she, who was at that point 40 years old, would have learned who they'd been born to. And I told myself that that would be a very complicated realization. And I then also noted that the people opposed to Roe, the people on the pro-life side, they felt that they were desperate to sort of learn who this person was, because they could say that he or she embodied their sort of, they were the living incarnation of their argument against abortion. They could say, aha, had Roe been the law at the time, you would have murdered this human being. So I was intent on finding this person. And when I then did, it led me into a much larger look at abortion in America.
Go back a little bit. Why did Norma McCorvey take that lawsuit? Her first two daughters she had put up for adoption. How did she end up fighting the law in this third case?
Yeah, you correctly note that she had already sort of placed two children for adoption. And it's important to note that people opposed to abortion, at least in America, they often say that, hey, if you have an abortion, it causes a woman emotional harm. And she should, they say, place that child up for adoption. In fact, the exact opposite is true. While, of course, there are individuals who suffer emotionally from having an abortion, the overwhelming majority of women who have an abortion express relief, not regret. Conversely, those who place the child for adoption often do feel sort of emotionally haunted by that, even if they feel that it was the right thing to do. Somewhere out there, they say, there is a child of theirs. So I mention that because Norma had already placed two children for adoption. She had suffered enormously for that. She was scarred by those experiences, and she did not want to go through it again. She did not wish to be a mother. She was unfit to be a mother. I uncover how she was a prostitute. She was a drug dealer. She was a drug user. Her life was very complicated and difficult. She was at the time a waitress in a string of lesbian bars and had all sorts of affairs. Her life was not stable. Anyway, she did not want to go through all of that again. And so she wanted to have an abortion. But abortion was, in 1969, when she conceived, illegal in Texas and in almost every other state in America. She could not afford to go to where abortion was legal. It was actually legal, for example, in California, where the governor, Ronald Reagan, was at that point sort of in favor of legalizing abortion. He had signed into law the most liberal abortion law in the country, but she couldn't afford to fly there. So she didn't want to go through this again, but she could not afford to have one. So she went to her adoption attorney and sort of lamented the place in life where she found herself. And this man, his name was Henry McCluskey, he said, you know what? I actually went to law school with a woman named Linda Coffey, who is now looking for a plaintiff to challenge the abortion laws here in Texas. And if you like, I can connect you with her. And that is exactly what happened.
So she ended up going to court. Did she take an active role in that court case, or did the lawyer fight it on her behalf entirely?
Yeah, you get to the sort of heart of the matter with that question, because Norma at that point did not care at all about furthering a woman's right to choose. She simply wanted an abortion herself. Her lawyers, Linda, and then the woman she connected with, a woman named Sarah Weddington, who then became very famous arguing the case in front of the Supreme Court, they needed a plaintiff. And they did not, it might have been a little late in the pregnancy. Norma was nearing the end of her second trimester, but they didn't even try to help Norma have an abortion, for example, to fly her to California. And Sarah was working at the time in an abortion referral network. Sarah, in fact, had had an abortion herself in Mexico, and they didn't help her. They simply needed a plaintiff. So I mention all of that because, no, Norma had nothing to do with the suit. She was sort of completely aloof from it, removed from it. Once she signed the affidavit and became the plaintiff, she sort of was forgotten by history and by her lawyers. And they pushed the case forward on her behalf. They then made it a class action suit so that they were suing sort of Texas and on behalf of all women, quote unquote, similarly situated.
So Norma was effectively used by abortion.
Absolutely.
Activists. Right.
Yeah. And the sad thing about that is later on, to fast forward, years go by, and in the mid to late 1980s, she decides that she actually is proud of what she came to call her law, my law, she said. And she wanted a seat at the table, but she wasn't sort of savvy. She wasn't educated. And the people on the pro-choice side, they marginalized her. They didn't really give her a seat at the table. In fairness to them, Norma was an unreliable sort of narrator to her own life story. She made up certain stories, etc. But they absolutely could have helped her to be part of their fight, and they didn't really want her there. And that fact was largely responsible for the fact that in 1995, Norma then switched to the other side, became a born-again Christian, and then sort of went to fight against Roe v. Wade for the pro-life side. There was an evangelical minister named Flip Benham, who set up what he called a crisis pregnancy center. There are lots of them in America, basically little sort of pro-life mom and pops that set up right next to abortion clinics and kind of give a woman going for an abortion the misimpression that they will help her do so. Then once she's sort of inside, they prey on her and say, you know what, actually, why do you want to do this? Abortion causes cancer, et cetera, which it doesn't, obviously. And Norma, they gave her love and attention that she did not get on the pro-choice side. So she then about-faced in 1995 and went to work for them.
6 years before that, in 1989, she decided that she wanted to trace her third child, that Roe baby. Doubt her motives, shall we say. You suggest that she wanted the publicity. She wanted to make money out of the child.
Absolutely. And I can sort of, there's lots of reasons that I say that. Look, Norma sort of wrung a living out of her plaintiffship. And that really started in earnest in 1989 when she went to a large march on Washington, a march for women. And while she was there, Gloria Allred, the celebrity feminist attorney, saw her and literally put her arm around her and then took her off to Hollywood and put her in front of the cameras and trotted her out in front of lots of press conferences, etc. And it was just then, exactly then, once she was represented by Gloria, that all of a sudden she started looking for that third child. Did she look for the second child? No. She was only interested in finding the third child. And obviously it was the third child whose sort of unknown identity was of great interest to people. The way that she did this was very depressing. She reached out to a tabloid, the National Enquirer, and gave them the date of birth of her third child and the place of birth. And then they found her in Washington State, and they told her that whether she liked it or not, they were going to press with a story about her. And a lawyer prevailed upon the tabloid not to use her name. But forevermore, that third child, Shelley Lynn Thornton, was sort of terrified that she would be uncovered and used as a sort of prop by either side. In fact, at that time, her mother and probably Shelley, too, was sort of on the pro-life side. She has since her mother's passed away, and Shelley calls herself pro-choice. But she was very upset and sort of scalded by that experience. And then what happened was she had a few uncomfortable conversations with Norm on the phone. She said, I want no part of this. And a few years later, when Norma then said that she was going to come visit her with her partner, Norma was gay. She had to renounce her homosexuality when she went over to the pro-life side, but she was as yet gay. Obviously, she remained so afterwards, but did not call herself that. But when she said that she wanted to visit, Shelley said, well, what do I tell my child that her grandmother is visiting with her partner? Norma then said that she needed to thank her for not aborting her. They got into a huge fight and they never spoke again. So it's a sad story.
It is a sad story.
Yeah.
Shelley did not know that she was, in fact, Baby Roe until when? She knew she was adopted.
That's right. Until 1989, just shy of her 19th birthday. But she never told her story, not once, not even to people of her family, until she spoke to me in 2013. And that's when she started to tell me her story. I wanted to sort of find her. I didn't know how to do so. And Norma did not wish to speak about that at that point. She later did. So I reached out to Norma's former partner, a woman Norma lived with for many years. And Norma had recently left her, and I went to see her, this woman, Connie Gonzalez, in Texas. And she told me that their house had been foreclosed on, and they were about to move. And she said, Norma's private papers were in the garage and were about to be thrown out. And I said, please don't throw those papers out. Those papers are now at a research library at Harvard. They enabled me to sort of write about her story and about abortion in America. And on one piece in those papers, there was the date of birth of the youngest child, which led me to her. When I first reached out to her, she said, you know, I'm not ready to speak. And I didn't reach out to her. I first reached out to her mother in case she didn't know who she'd been born to. I didn't want to upend her life. But after I then found her two sisters, the other children, her half siblings, the other children Norma had given birth to, and they were very eager to sort of participate and tell their story and meet. Then Shelley said, wait, I would like to do so too. And as you noted at the top of your show, I then brought all three of them together. They'd all sort of looked for each other in vain. And it was a very moving coming together.
Norma, at this stage, was still keen on getting hold of Shelley and making some form of relationship with her. Shelley was adamant that she didn't want that. What kind of a life had Shelley had? Was she bitter towards her mother or just conflicted?
You know, at heart of Shelley's difficulties was not the fact that she had been born to Jane Roe. It was something much more common, because obviously she alone was the one, the human being whose conception led to Roe v. Wade. What really was most difficult for her, she told me, was simply the fact that she had been born unwanted. And there are obviously tens of millions of children around the world who are born unwanted. And this was what was most difficult for her, the fact that she was then placed for adoption. And the fact that her mother was Norma McCorvey was sort of second to that. But when she then had those very difficult exchanges with Norma, and Norma was a very difficult person, And I go into the reasons why it didn't sort of start with her. I go into her family, which we could discuss. But that was hardest for Shelley. And yet, despite all she sort of endured, being sort of the role baby and also having been scalded by those conversations with Norma, she nonetheless felt for Norma. And at the end of Norma's life, she felt bad for her, having had her life defined by abortion and by Roe v. Wade, something that Shelley wanted really no part of. And at the end of Norma's life, when she was dying, Shelley was going back and forth. Should I visit her? Should I not? And Norma, meanwhile, was sort of very wary of Shelley. And what you see is, on a very human level, if a person wishes to have an abortion but is not able to, that is a very difficult and scarring thing for both the mother and the child. A very difficult thing.
So she never saw Norma on her deathbed. I wonder how she feels about it now.
She said at the time when I was speaking with her a few days before Norma died that she probably would regret that for the rest of her life. She was very sort of open about that. And yet she said, I'm not the one who owes Norma an apology. Norma owes me an apology, meaning for the way that she had spoken with her. And so they never did reconcile. What is a lovely thing is that Shelley, though, was very happy to sort of find out who her sisters were, to meet them. And today she's sort of close with one of them. Obviously, being related to someone is not the same thing as having a family. But she does feel very connected to her.
What was Shelley's life like in her adoptive family?
It was not easy. Her parents were themselves a complicated couple. One of them, her mother, was married and living on a military base when she met Shelley's father. She ran off with him, and he meanwhile had a whole handful of children with a whole handful of women. And then he developed a drinking problem. And within a few years, the mom sort of whisked Shelley away as far away as she could within the United States. She went to Washington State in the northwest tip of the country. And, you know, that in and of itself, Roe aside, was obviously a difficult thing for the child.
I'm guessing, Joshua, that, I mean, I'm speaking personally, I suppose, the hardest thing in writing this book was not to judge.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to think that what really marks my book above all, and what separates it, if I may say, from the overwhelming majority of the books on abortion, is that it is a very fair book. I wrote about people with empathy. The epigraph in my book comes from Moby Dick, and Melville writes, "See how elastic our stiff prejudices grow when love comes to bend them." I do believe it's difficult to be prejudiced against a person or even a group of people if you know them. And so what I did was I really tried to humanize the issue here. In our country, abortion is really, you know, grounds for a civil war. And I wrote about people on both sides of the issue and wrote about abortion through people, really not politics. And just to give one example of how this becomes humanized, the very same things that sort of pulled Norma and her family apart are, in my opinion, the things that pull America apart on this issue. So Norma was the third straight generation in her family to have an unwanted pregnancy. And when you see what happens as a result of those, that sort of seeming, well, of those unwanted pregnancies, I say, you know where this difficulty comes from. Her family was very religious. They were Catholics, then Pentecostals, then Jehovah's Witnesses, and sex was seen as something illicit and sinful, all the more so for Norma when she came out to her mother. Her mother told me unapologetically that she beat her. And so you see what happens when sex and religion are seemingly incompatible, irreconcilable. And that, in my opinion, is the very issue at the root of our problems in this country. We have sort of puritanical roots, and sex and religion are often at odds. And of course, that problem has then been politicized and absolutized and brought us to this sort of miserable moment. But yes, I really tried my best to be fair. And it's been very gratifying to me that people in this country who don't agree on much do agree that they were fairly represented in my book.
I mean, Shelley obviously emerges from this as as a kind of a shining light in many ways. But nobody is covered with virtue in it. I mean, from the pro-abortionists and the anti-abortionists, Gloria Allred, the lawyers, the activists, everybody kind of trampled over Norma.
They did. And they also, you know, what you realize in this country anyway, it's the leaders on both sides of the movement that really have sort of benefited from its politicization. And it's the people sort of on the grassroots level who may disagree, but their beliefs are genuine. They earnest, you know, I believe that abortion is fraught for good reason. I happen to be pro-choice, but I understand why it's a complicated issue. And, you know, you're exactly right. The sort of leaders on both sides, they didn't treat Norma well, and they are largely to blame for where we are. You know, the both sides have become really sort of extremists. They would not recognize way back when, just to give an example on the pro-choice side, when President Clinton spoke of abortion, he said that it ought to be something safe, legal, and rare. And the people nowadays will say, well, why rare? It shouldn't be rare at all. It's only a social and moral good. It only empowers women. So they are far more sort of extreme than they used to be. Similarly, on the pro-life side, once upon a time, it would have been unheard of for the leaders of the of this movement to say that abortion ought to be illegal, even in cases of rape and incest. But now you have state after state after state passing these sort of trigger bans, which will say that if Roe, in fact, is overturned, abortion will be illegal from the moment of conception in all cases. So our country has become truly divided and, you know, polarized. And as divided as it is, it's going to be even more divided. Right after Roe is likely overturned, you will now literally, if you're a woman, you know, on this side of the fence, you'll be able to have an abortion. On that, you won't. It will be very depressing. And as always is the case, sadly, it will be poor women and girls and often women of color who are not able to have access to abortion.
You predicted that Roe versus Wade would come under attack. Were you surprised, however, when the Alito judgment came out and it seemed absolutely certain that Roe versus Wade would go?
You know, I actually wasn't. And the reason I wasn't surprised, and I had to write the afterword to my paperback before the moment we're in, so I had to sort of, you know, put that down on paper. But the reason I wasn't surprised is because if you listen to the oral arguments in the case that has put abortion back in front of the court, there were basically two justices out of the nine who might go either way. We knew where everyone else sort of stood. And if one of these justices was sort of not for overturning Roe, then Roe would not be overturned. But those two justices, Kavanaugh and Barrett, it was pretty clear that they are for overturning Roe. Kavanaugh kept speaking about the other examples in the history of the Supreme Court when precedents were overturned, and obviously now a precedent of almost 50 years would have to sort of be overturned. And Barrett kept speaking about the fact that adoption should be considered a viable alternative to abortion. So it sort of seemed that this is where they were going. The Chief Justice is the only of the nine justices, Justice Roberts, who is likely not to vote along the sort of political lines. He was appointed by a Republican, but in all likelihood, not in all likelihood, definitely, he does not wish to overturn Roe. He doesn't want to see the court. He doesn't want the public to perceive the court as a political body. And right now,
well, that's too late, Joshua, isn't it?
It is. And you're 100% right. What he's trying to do, though, right now, is to win one of those justices over to his side, to say, you know what, we will further circumscribe abortion in this country, but we will not absolutely overturn it. And I don't believe he will be successful.
You don't?
No, I think Roe will actually be overturned. And that should happen within just about 1 month.
As you said earlier, Shelley saw the difficulty of being born unwanted. She did not see that as baby Roe, she represented the sanctity of life. That's a very complicated position for her to hold, and a very complicated idea for us to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, she didn't want to sort of represent anything. She wanted to be only her own person. She said over and again to me, you know, this had nothing to do with me, meaning I didn't choose this. It was thrust upon me. But of course, it does have things to do with her, even though she didn't choose it. Nonetheless, the circumstances of her conception and of her birth were sort of extraordinary. And obviously, the fact that she exists is at the heart of this issue. But as I wrote and as I say, I understand why at least she can say that she less represents sort of the sanctity of life than the much more sort of common predicament of being born unwanted. What I found very interesting and sort of very moving is that all three of Norma's daughters, who all had very different lives, they all wished to sort of be their own people, and they wished to sort of stop the patterns of behavior that in previous generations led to them. So Melissa, the eldest child, for example, was placed for adoption by her mother, Norma, and then raised by her grandmother, meaning Norma's mother. She said, you know what? This is really ultimately about being a mom. And my mother, meaning Norma, was not able to be a mother. My grandmother wasn't able to be. My great-grandmother struggled. I want to be a mother to my children. And she has devoted herself to being a mother to her children. And she even devoted herself to Norma at the end of Norma's life. Norma represented tens of millions of people on both sides of the issue, but at the end of her life, she was entirely alone, except for Melissa. Melissa was there with her partner and her daughters, and that was very, very moving.
Exemplifying the complications of this story is that at one point, Norma said to Shelley, "You should thank me for not aborting you."
Yes, that was in that conversation that they had in 1992, a few years after Norma had that, you know, that sort of private eye working for the tabloid, go find her. Norma, unfortunately, was not a person who was good to those closest to her. And she would often be really sort of miserable in the things that she said. She struck out at people. She gave as good as she got. And, you know, on the one hand, she's sort of a remarkable person for, although she wasn't educated, she left high school after 10th grade. She was able to sort of, she was savvy in the way that she negotiated these very difficult big egos and personalities on both sides of the issue. On the other hand, you know, she could really be cruel, and she certainly was cruel to Shelley when she said that.
She wrote two autobiographies herself, but you've found those and they have turned out to be unreliable, yeah?
Beyond unreliable. They really are sort of fiction. What was interesting to me was if you looked over and again at all the lies, Norma said she was raped. Norma said she was beaten by her husband. She was actually married at 16, quickly divorced. Norma said that her mother kidnapped her child when in fact she just relinquished the child to adoption. Norma said that when she wanted an abortion, she went to a clinic and it had just been shuttered and there was dried blood on the floor. Everything was always dramatic. What she was doing was sort of reimagining herself, not as a sinner, meaning someone who wanted to have an abortion or someone who had sex outside of marriage or someone who didn't want to be a mother, but rather as a victim. All of her lies were sort of in the service of victimhood. And the truth of the matter was, you know, she was a victim. She was a victim, not in those very sort of dramatic ways, but rather in the sense that she simply wanted to have an abortion. She was not able to. And that one sort of inarguable trauma was really enough to redirect her entire life.
Stepping back and looking at the big picture, you predict that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. The Supreme Court, Judge Alito and others may well argue, as they have, that this will give the power to decide to the people in terms of the electoral processes in the individual states. Why do you find that less than convincing?
Well, it is entirely true that after, you know, if the Supreme Court sort of rules as we imagine and they overturn Roe, that it will go back to the states. But what they want to say is that, you know, this will be sort of a tidy process. It's actually going to be complete chaos. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it will it will divide the country further. These fights are now not going to stop, but rather the people who want to see abortion outlawed, they're not going to be content with having abortion only illegal in those states where it's illegal. They're going to say, hey, and there are already laws being formed in certain states to say that a woman cannot leave her state to go to another state to have an abortion, or that she's not able to have sort of medical abortion, pills sent to her in the mail. These fights are going to continue and amplify. And again, you know, it unfortunately will come down to class and money and who has access and who doesn't. It will not be about, it will be, I guess, ultimately also about geography. And how is that fair? You know, of course, on the other side, you're going to have organizations trying desperately to bring poor women from one state where abortion is not legal now to another state where it is legal. Of course, stepping back also legally, you know, the Supreme Court wants to say that, hey, this was there was no constitutional basis for granting a woman a right to abortion. But there's a lot of hypocrisy there. There are other cases where where a conservative court intuited a right to privacy for things not having to do with abortion. For example, the right to sort of educate your child where you wish. There's a famous case from 1925 about that. So, you know, there's a lot of picking and choosing. And as is always the case in America, abortion is sort of unique. It's not a coincidence that it was a Senate confirmation hearing of a justice that had to do with abortion that forever politicized it way back in 1987 when Ronald Reagan tried to appoint a man named Robert Bork to the court. It became a very political thing. And it's not a coincidence that it had to do with abortion again right now that an opinion was leaked. Abortion in our country is always the exception, the tail that wags the dog, and it's a very depressing thing.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Joshua Prager, whose book is called The Family Row.